Yeah, I'm really delighted to be doing this. Thanks to Diana for the support, and thanks to all of you for showing up, or showing up, if you know what I mean. It's something that I've always been interested in. I've actually, many years ago, when we did our first Bach Festival around 1995, I did a little lunchtime session called Parallel Bach Universes. And this is sort of starting with some of that material, but also moving on. It's always fascinated me that Bach fascinates everyone. And it's a little bit difficult. I mean, even people who aren't, you know, serious musicians oftentimes are very interested in Bach and moved by Bach. And philosophers are interested in Bach. And there have been many books written from a non-musical standpoint about Bach's works. And one of the questions I have is why? You know, what is it about Bach? And I think you all, you know, being obviously into Bach, or you wouldn't be here, have your own ideas about this. So these are some of these ideas. They're just my ideas. But one of the things that for me is so powerful about Bach, and that people mention a lot, is his mastery of what we call the vertical and the horizontal aspect of music. So harmony and melody slash counterpoint, counterpoint being the combination of more than one melody together. And he is kind of the acknowledged expert, the go-to person for, in both those fields. And those are such primary fields for all music making, really, except for maybe music making that doesn't have pitch, you know, percussion music, that sort of thing. But in general, we deal with the sounds that people or instruments make vertically. We call them chords, and the combinations of sounds that are made by people singing or playing their own individual line, and how do those weave together? But that's certainly one of them. Another one is Bach's incredible spirituality. Though he wrote much secular music, he's particularly well known for his sacred music. And even for those of us who aren't Lutherans or even Christians, there's a lot of depth in how he explores the various topics of life and death and hope and loss and all of those things. So that's certainly a big one. Many composers, of course, shared that point of view. And then Bach had a desire and in fact a compulsion to be a kind of an encyclopedist, a musical encyclopedist. He put together many projects which sort of showed Bach on X, you know, Bach on the chorale prelude, Bach on sacred music, we call that the B minor mass. Bach on preludes and fugues, keyboard preludes and fugues, we call that the double well-tempered clavier. And there are many, many similar ones, some of them incomplete. But he had a real desire to kind of collect his own knowledge, and his knowledge was deeply based in past knowledge. So he's sort of explicitly left us with treasure troves that sort of tell us what these forms were like during Bach's time and what Bach did with them. So those are several reasons. But I'm going to start the presentation proper with a certain angle. And this angle is I'm calling it Bach's wide range in multiple parameters. In other words, I'm going to give you some little musical examples from Bach's works that delineate kind of the range of Bach, how far he goes one way to the other on 10 different parameters. And the musical examples will hopefully speak for themselves. But this will kind of fill in the picture on why are we so interested in Bach? Why is Bach so fascinating? Why do so many musicians want access to Bach, including people who play instruments that Bach never heard of? And even non-musicians who find ways nowadays with electronics to manipulate and play on and vary and just do things like using like Legos, you know, using Bach as Legos to put them together. So first of all, I'm going to do something called a share screen. And for a while, you'll only be able to see what's on my screen. So first of all, I'm going to do that, remembering to share computer sound. And click share. Now, with any luck, you'll now be seeing something that says Zoom. And raise your hand if you can see that. Okay, those of you who I can see are raising your hand, so I'll optimistically assume that everybody can. Diana, I forgot to mention, my phone is sitting right here. One of my fears about this thing is that somehow communication will become severed, but I'll keep talking for an hour or more without knowing that nobody's there on the other end. So my phone is right here. If you lose me, please give me a call and I will try. We'll try to fix it.
I promise I won't let you go on forever by yourself.
Okay, love you.
Phone's right here. I'll take it.
So I have this set of clips. This is a sound editing program. I think a few of you used it to do our pandemic recording projects. And what this is 20 different clips showing these parameters. And the first parameter is from serious to joyful and everything in between. Here's the clip for serious. So this is an expressive piece, of course, but it's very serious. Germans would use the word ernst. It's very sincere and kind of down here, and you have this sort of look on your face when you sing it or play it, or maybe even listen to it. And then immediately after, in the same piece, that's the Kyrie 2 from the B minor Mass, he breaks loose in a completely different direction. What could be more joyful? What could be more ebullient? What musically speaking could make you want to smile more than that? And those things, as I say, come right next to each other in the B minor Mass. The next set of parameters I'm calling specific, and I mean in this case specifically instrumentation, but it applies to many other areas as well, specific to flexible. In Cantata 106, one of his earliest cantatas, which we performed a year ago in November, in the very first movement, the Sonatina, Bach gives us this very specific and very wonderful orchestral sound. Two recorders, two violas da gamba, cello and organ. Antique sound, even in Bach's time, and a very specific sound. You could do it on other instruments, but you would lose something enormous. And the next example, which is, you know, sort of in the flexible category, is from the Art of the Fugue, the first counterpoint in the Art of Fugue. And in this piece, Bach specifies no instrumentation at all. You can play it or sing it on anything, and the composer won't complain. He's dead anyway, but even if he was alive, he clearly wanted to leave it open. Here we have it played on string instruments. This aspect of flexibility is something we're going to explore a lot, because people have gone way beyond Bach's own imagination, I'm sure, performing his works on, as I say, instruments that he never even heard of. But I like to think he would have approved. And I do think that many of these explorations that people have made work, and in some ways tell us something more about the musical work than we might have known before. We might even go from them back to Bach's instrumentation and find that we've learned something new. So in the next set of parameters is monochromatic to technicolor. So Bach was very good at kind of limiting his range of color, and he loved at times to explore the whole vast array of color available with his instrumentarium. Here is the prelude from the C major cello suite. And of course, I'm not saying that within that single instrument and those single lines that there isn't color. There's plenty of color there, but it's sort of monochromatic. If you had to give a name to it, maybe it would be brown. I'm not sure. It's kind of serious, and it makes you think, obviously, of the cello. But then listen, in contrast to that, listen to this. First gives us the drums, and then he gives us the trumpets, and then he gives us the strings, and then he gives us the winds, and he's kind of reveling in it, like, woohoo, look what I have available, and look what I'm going to do for you in this fabulous piece called the Christmas Oratorio. Another obvious one is vocal to instrumental. A lot of you singers out there will be singing along with that. You can hear that there is a bass line, an instrumental bass line happening, but that piece can be done a cappella, no problem, and many, many times has been, as opposed to. Excuse me. So the next parameter, vocal instrumental, as opposed to, this all instrumental piece. This is the opening aria from the Goldbergs. And many of you know the Goldbergs, but pay attention because these are going to come back in varied form in a minute. Here's the opening of the aria from the Goldberg Variations. No voices in this. Or are there? Stay tuned. The next set is contrapuntal versus harmonic, or as I was saying before, the horizontal aspect and the vertical aspect. And I'm going to play you an example from the first movement of Cantata 80, Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott. And it's one of the contrapuntal tour de forces of musical history. He writes the fugue based upon the chorale theme, but then later on at the end of each segment, he brings the chorale theme in the very top voices, which are the oboes, and in the very bottom voice, which is the double bass. Here's the opening of Ein feste Burg. Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott. It's all about linearity, baby. And then at the end, as he almost always does in his chorale cantatas, he always does, we have the same tune, but in four-part harmony, all more or less lined up. And we'll have more chorales as we go along. The next set of parameters is kind of whimsical. Sorry about that. It's called cerebral to giddy. Here's cerebral. This is the ricercare, six-part ricercare from the musical Offering. Extended, well-argued piece based upon what's called the regal theme given to Bach by Frederick the Great in 1747. As opposed to that, from the famous orchestral suite involving flute, we have the Badinerie. This used to be the ringtone on my phone. Giddy, you see what I mean? The next set is practical to abstract. And I'm gonna delineate practical with one of the Orgelbüchlein preludes. This is from his Weimar period. And they're practical in the sense that all these 40 pieces were intended for for church services and often to introduce hymns. So they're what's the Germans called Gebrauchsmusik, music for use. But they're also incredible. And then the crab canon from the musical Offering. This is a crab canon is a piece of music that can be played against itself, can be played backwards as well as forwards. And it's a very ramified form. This is a kind of a computer version of it, which kind of brings out that sort of abstract aspect. Half the time in this piece, you feel like your face is melting, you know? It would be good for a certain kind of horror movie. Okay, and then personal versus, or intimate versus grand. Everybody knows this piece. And, you know, you feel like you're in love with that melody, you know, or the person who's playing it. There's something very intimate and very personal about that. It's, of course, why it's often used for weddings. And then on the grand aspect, many of you will recognize. The opening of his fabulous Magnificat from 1724. The next one is again kind of a whimsical name, puckish versus monumental. Here's the puckish. It's the D major fugue. It's an organ fugue. I forget the BWV number, but it's a four-part organ fugue, and it begins with the following nose thumbing theme. It breaks all the rules. One of the rules it breaks is you can't do sequences too many times. And Bach is really good about that. But here he's making a point. He's like, fuck you. I can do that if I want to. We could do the whole rest of the session on that piece alone, but we're not going to do that. And then to contrast with that, and I have to be able to see if I can, there we go. Okay, now I can see past it. We have something called Monumental. Everybody knows this piece. Finally, I have to see if I can get you guys back. I can't see you anymore. Hello, hello, hello. Ah, there you are. Okay, I see what I can do. Great. And the final two parameters are obvious. One, small scale to large scale. And for this, I've chosen two movements of the B minor mass. Here's the Benedictus opening. Just two lines with the organ providing a little harmonic accompaniment. And just before that, we had the opposite end of the spectrum. So there's 10 scales that show you a little bit about what of Bach's range of how much he could do in given parameters. And those are only a choice. So now let's go into the Alt Bach. Now I chose the name Alt Bach for a reason. It's kind of a pun. As most of you know, the word alt or alta means old. And in fact, the phrase old Bach comes from his visit to Frederick the Great, which I mentioned before. His son, C.P.E. Bach, was working there and had asked his father to come, and Frederick the Great was expecting Bach to come. And supposedly, when Bach was announced to the king turned to his musicians and said, "Gentlemen, old Bach has come." But alt, as you know, also means alternate. And so we're going to explore some different ways of doing Bach, and I have a lot of examples. So I'm going to try to go against type and not talk very much, and let you hear these marvelous renditions. And can you all raise your hand if you can see my document that I put up there? Okay, good. So you can see we have multiple examples of some of these pieces or some of these genre. And I tried to choose, and you wouldn't believe the amount of examples that are available out there. It's really unbelievable. Even I, because I said I've been into this off and on for years, had no idea how much was out there these days. And not only different renditions of pieces, but pieces in the style of and variations on Bach pieces, pieces that sort of take off from Bach and go other places. And videos of all different types and analyses, which have scrolling. You'll see a few of these, I think, the music scrolls by, so you can see exactly what's going on. It's really, I'm kind of a technology doubter half the time, but the other half the time I'm kind of amazed and enthralled by what technology can do for us and with us. So anyway, I'm gonna give you several of these. You will have already heard a little bit of the piece, as in this one. You heard Yo-Yo Ma playing the beginning of the cello suite. And now we're going to hear somebody play it on the melodica, which sounds strange, but actually works very well. And not only is he playing it, but this is a perpetual motion piece. There's no room to breathe. If you're playing a wind instrument, there is actually a flute piece that's similar to this in that it never takes a break. the flautist has to just insert some space here and there because he or she has to breathe. Not this guy, he circular breathes. He breathes in through his nose, holds it in his cheeks and blows it out, and he breathes in more as he's blowing out. It's a wind tech, wind and brass technique. And all this, this was posted long before COVID. I like to think of him as a poor, isolated person who's cheering himself up by Bach. And I love his face. You know, this shows how far afield you can go. That means that's not a cello. There's nothing like a cello. And certainly that particular instrument didn't exist when Bach was alive. And yet, if you listen to the whole thing, it actually brings some beautiful things out about the piece. And now, you wouldn't think that the ukulele would necessarily be a good instrument for that, but I really like this performance. As we build these things up, you know, as I was building these things up, I was thinking about it. It gave me a kind of a nice feeling of like people all over the world with all kind of different instruments and all kind of different talents or not, and are you know, this guy who's been dead for, you know, 270 years, his music resounds all over the world because it's so compelling. And I don't know, that kind of made me feel a little better. So now, in terms of orchestral pieces, there's been many many transcriptions, and a lot of these things are what are called transcriptions, whether or not they've actually been written down as a specific transcription for an instrument is beside the point. If something is played on an instrument for which it was not intended, it's usually called a transcription. So here's one, an interesting one. Bach wrote a concerto for four harpsichords based upon a concerto by Vivaldi, and these arrangers have made an arrangement of that arrangement, played on multiple xylophones. Sorry. Which gives it a kind of a magical music box type feel that's not at all like the original, and yet entirely satisfying and beautiful in its own way. Another piece, many of you will have heard of Walter Carlos, later became Wendy Carlos, and he created something called Switched on Bach using one of the very earliest music synthesizers called a Moog, M-O-O-G, synthesizer. Here's the Sinfonia from Cantata 29 as transcribed and rendered by Wendy Carlos. And many of you will remember that this was electrifying when it first came out. It blew your mind. First of all, the sounds that the synthesizer made, you know, which now are pedestrian, you know, they actually are now digital synthesizers that can give you the Moog sound. But also it was a kind of a statement about Bach. There's something about machine, there can be something machine-like about Bach. And this is rendered that way. If you listen to some older recordings of Bach, they used to call it a denigrating term for it was sewing machine music, and especially for a piece like this. But it's also kind of cheerful and like non-problematic. You don't think about people torturing themselves in a practice room for 20 years to try to be able to do this. It's just this sort of magical thing. And another orchestral example I have is, this is sort of similar to the xylophone one, but a completely different effect. The first movement of the Brandenburg III on mandolins. To me, it's like warm and friendly, and you just want to pick it up in your arms and cuddle it. Love it, love it, love it. Okay, so now we're going to go along to the Swingle Singers. How many people remember the Swingle Singers? Raise your hand. Okay, the very first Bach I ever did anything with, sang, or probably even listened to, or at least consciously, was this first example that I'm going to play. It's a bourée from one of the dance suites, but it's done a little bit differently. I think there's an ad here, which I can't avoid, so I apologize. Nope. It's kind of silly at this distance in time, but it actually was pretty enlivening at the time. And I think the adding a walking bass to jazz, to Bach, I think a lot of Bach actually has what you might call a walking bass, but just adding a little swing time and the walking bass kind of tells you something different about Bach. It kind of, it reveals something about Bach. At least it does to me. And this one might show that. This one's in color too. Who knew? And you see there, they don't have the instrumental bass or the snare drum. They just have that guy on the left who's doing the instrumental bass. And just with that, for some of you choir people will remember, I sometimes ask you to snap on the offbeat when we're doing stuff to kind of enliven it. And I learned that from the Swingle Singers of all places. They're fun to listen to. It's kind of like a blast from the past. And then here's another aspect. When you think about it, transcriptions of Bach have been being done all the time. He made transcriptions of his own works. He often changed his own works, reorchestrated them, works that were originally for voices, like the famous chorale prelude on Wacht auf. Dun, da, 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 da. That was originally a cantata movement, and he made it into an instrumental piece. So he did transcriptions of his own works. Other people right away started doing transcriptions of his works. And of course the piano, what we know as the piano, its predecessor was the forte piano. And that's one of the reasons he went to Berlin in 1747, was to play Frederick the Great's forte pianos. And it's a piano sounding instrument. It's somewhat different. It doesn't have a steel frame, but it's much more, in some ways, much more like the piano. And so even playing Bach on the piano is a transcription, because Bach, as far as we know, didn't write anything for the piano. What I'm going to point out here is that interpretation changes. And if I had a little more time, I would have put a mid 20th century recording of the B minor Mass on here, but I'm skipping that. And I'm going to give you a Baroque ensemble, somewhat of about the same scale a little smaller choir than we have, doing the beginning of the Dona Nobis of the B minor Mass. So there you have a beautiful choral sound you can kind of bask in, and it's one of the great, and if you look at this thing, can you, if you could see, I don't know if you could see the whole thing, but you could just see the shape of the piece. And that's not just the interpretation, that's the shape that Bach wrote. And virtually anyone who interprets the B minor Mass is going to end up with a shape, a dynamic shape like that, because it's kind of built into the piece, even though there's not a single dynamic marking in the score. Now here, is another Baroque ensemble, but with one voice per part. And I think you can call this a transcription in a way, although Joshua Rifkin and many others claim that for many of Bach's pieces, they would have been done with one voice per part. It's a different sound. Some people call this recording the B minor madrigal because of the just four voices. And you notice that over here, when it gets really loud, it doesn't get as loud because there's not 30 or 40 singers singing there, but it's magnificent, but in a different kind of way. And it puts the orchestra more in the foreground, which is a different kind of sound. So yeah, I would say that is a transcription in its own kind of way. Now I have one more example from the B minor Mass, and this one, I don't know if your video will cooperate, but this is a guy who likes to play with himself, sing with himself. So he, here, he conducts and sings all five parts of the Cum Sancto Spiritu from the B minor Mass. Check it out. If any of you could do that with that movement, or in fact any other movement of the B minor Mass, you'll never have to audition again. I'm just saying. This guy is incredible. I mean, you know, it's very rough sounding, obviously, and he's being goofy on purpose, but to be able to do that is quite an amazing skill. Sometime I'm going to track down some of his other stuff and see what else he's done. The Toccata and Fugue in D minor, which we heard the opening of on organ, has been done in a million different ways. This one, of course, you all know from Fantasia. Whoops. Certainly the first I ever knew it was that, from in the late 60s, going to late night showings of Fantasia, to tell you the truth. And I won't tell you the details of that because it's a mixed audience here. But check this out in contrast to that. Talk about a scale difference. Mm-hmm. in contrast to that, try this on for size. Sorry. He does the whole thing. It's pretty amazing. Anybody ever see the tin drum? I had to walk out on that movie for some reason. I can't remember why, but I do remember that scene. And now we're going to go on to the Goldberg Variations. And you already heard a harpsichord interpretation of the opening. And here's a transcription, in a sense. Here's Anders Schiff playing it on the piano. It's quite a different piece, still incredible. Of course, the piano gives us not only a different tone, but also the opportunity of having different notes be louder and softer. And that's one of the reasons it makes it so attractive. And this has become a piece, except for dyed-in-the-wool early music people, I think most people probably prefer this on the piano. But there are other options. And there are wonderful transcriptions of the Goldbergs for melodic instruments. Here's one for viols. And some of you will remember Wendy Gillespie, who was in the viol consort that played with us in the Pretorius concert in November. She's on this recording. And it brings out something completely different. This is one of the early variations. By the way, there's some terms here. You will not be tested at the end, but there's two opposing terms, and I could have used them as some of my parameters. One is Verschmelzungsklang, all melted together sound, and a piano is that. It has an even timbre and sound. Of course, you can make notes sharp and loud and soft, but the tone of the instrument is intended to be even from top to bottom. Similarly with a consort of viols. And of course, you know, with the contrapuntal piece, having different players play it, especially if you're seeing it live, then you can follow the lines individually, as opposed to them all being contained in this kind of cramped space of a keyboardist's hands. It's possible you visually follow the instruments playing and the players moving and such, entering and having rests, etc. But there's this guy called Yuri Stein. He's a jazz pianist and composer, an amazing person. And Yuri Stein has, in 2001 or so, he recorded the Goldbergs, but he added a lot of variations and he changed things around. One of the things he did was he used the opposite of Verschmelzungsklang on many of the variations. He used Spaltklang. And Spaltklang means a spalt is like a fissure. And so a Spaltklang is the sound of multiple very different sounding instruments. So here's one of the early variation in Yuri Stein's version. So this violin and trumpet, instead of two violins, let's say, or instead of all on the piano and the harpsichord, kind of gives us a different window into the piece. And as it gets more complicated, like for three and four part pieces, we are able to just discern the individual lines even more clearly. And obviously, it, from a tone world point of view, it kind of gives us a more colorful palette to deal with. Now, some of these get a little bit odd, so hold on to your hat. Huh? This voice creeps in here and there in some of these variations, and you kind of think maybe it's Bach, but it's not very clearly spelled out in the liner notes, so you have to use your imagination. Then here's a very different kind of variation, and this actually is hews quite closely to one of the variations in Bach's Goldberg Variations, but it's voiced a little bit differently. Get the idea? And he's playing with our heads. It's actually a real tour de force, because he seriously knows the Goldbergs, and basically every note of the Goldbergs are in this thing, but there's more. It's kind of like a postmodern take on the Goldberg Variations. Highly, highly recommended. I'll just play the very beginning of this because I can't resist. I never have been able to figure out exactly how this relates, but it's just fantastic. So there you go, that's reason enough. And I've tried to hear dum 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 in that in every possible way I can, and I've completely failed. So I think it's just in there for contrast, or just because it's a kick-ass piece. And then finally, I'm going to play a little bit of the Quod Libet, in which he makes, which is a Quod Libet is a combination of multiple songs. So he combines Bach combines his theme with several popular songs of the era, and Uri Stein put some more songs in, as you'll be able to hear, I'm sure. Surrey with the Fringe on Top comes in, and several other songs as well, including the popular songs of Bach's era that were in the original version of it. Now that's a fairly deep thing, but I think it's really an incredible kind of reimagining. It includes all the notes of Bach, but it also kind of piggybacks on that in a wonderful way. Partitas and sonatas, okay, I'm kind of a bluegrass person, especially kind of a modern bluegrass kind of person, and I love Bela Fleck, so I'm gonna play him and Chris Thiele for you on the Bach, in a Bach partita, originally for violin. Both Bela Fleck and Chris Thiele have written about learning Bach well into their careers, and then taking on Bach, basically, and the incredible effect that it had on them. Here's Chris Thiele. If you don't know Chris Thiele, you should. He's well worth listening to. Thank you. got to believe Bach is smiling when he hears that, right? I mean, that, I love his dynamics. He's such has always had such incredible dynamic control. Excuse me. Yeah, I'm going to skip down a little bit. I'll give you, this is a Spaltklang. Remember, Spaltklang is with multiple different sounding instruments of one of Bach's three-part inventions. It includes Bela Fleck on banjo, Chris Seely on mandolin, and the great Edgar Meyer on bass. So good-natured, if you know what I mean. It kind of just makes you feel better about humanity to listen to something like that. And now, as I mentioned before, some people have gone fairly far afield, or they've kind of used Bach as a starting point. I'm just going to give you a few little examples. Here's the Italian Concerto, a keyboard piece by Bach played on the piano. And then I'm going to give you a version by the jazz pianist Gabriele Montero, and Montero incorporates but surrounds the Bach with how should I put it? Let's see. She sort of cocoons it in a web of additional music. So at first you'll hear a theme, which is not what you just heard, but then you'll hear the opening theme enter. You can almost say that she uses the Bach as a jumping off point. Much of the Bach is incorporated, but it's sort of riffed upon and expanded. It can be very exciting to listen to. Here's an amazing coincidence. This piece is a setting, it's an improvisation on the Bach, the chorale tune, but also a specific Bach chorale arrangement of O Mensch, Bewein dein Sünde groß. And I just discovered this. I had the CD, but I hadn't listened to it in many, many years. And I was amazed to realize that it's based upon the exact Bach chorale harmonization of this tune that I sent out last Wednesday for you guys to practice with on our weekly Bach chorale. I'll play the opening and then I'll play some of the improv. This guy, I don't know, I can't quite describe it, but His improvisations can make you weep. And he adds soprano saxophone. Then he winds down at the end of the chorale. He ends the chorale as Bach does, and then he's kind of, they sort of start ruminating. Thank you. wonderful places. This was recorded at Yoshi's a long time ago, and it's a trio, bass and soprano sax and piano. Highly recommend Irish Stein. And we can send you links and all the details after the fact, in case you want to pursue some of this stuff. Now, oh boy, now we get to the fun part. Well, this is a very serious thing that I thought I'd throw in just to kind of set the tone for this last little segment.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to play at this time Liebster Jesu Mein Verlanger by Johann Sebastian Bach. That's Bach. Woof, woof.
But on a totally different tone, I discovered this. Some of you have probably seen this before. I think I saw it a long time ago, but I still can't believe it. And it might, I don't even know if it's real. Somebody should check it for us. But this is something else. It begins with a little sort of exploration of what you're about to see. So you're out in the woods. And these guys are setting this thing up. They have mics, cameras.
They go on.
Think. Is it something we should do, Diana? I really want to do this on stage, okay?
I'm gonna start working on it right now. We're
getting yeah. we'll have to fundraise for it. Exactly. Now let me just wrap up. Well, I kind of want to show you that this is the wonderful arrangement of Art of the Fugue by the Canadian Brass. That's real well worth checking out on your own, and we'll send you a link to that. But just take a quick look at this. This guy's a nut. It's kind of a trip to watch the lines as they intersect and the heads cross when the lines cross, and that's what happens in that piece. I don't know whether he actually took static pictures of himself blowing each bottle and then I guess that's, and then somehow in video connected it all together. But again, if you can do that in tune, then you're in the choir, okay? And now, finally, I want to play you, and I want to play this whole piece. Many of you, raise your hand if you ever performed took piano lessons and played Bach's, the first prelude from the Well-Tempered Clavier. The one, that kind of perpetual motion one. Well, I bet you never played it like this. These people are called the boom whackers. The end of our first virtual Bach talk. Let me put stop sharing so I can see you all and you can see each other. Oh my God, look at how many. Oh God, how beautiful. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. And like I say, Diane and I will put our heads together and send out some resources if you want to follow up any of these threads and do some listening on your own. And of course, I want to hear from you. I don't know, do we have time to have a few questions or anything? Diana, what do you think?
If I'm gonna let you unmute yourself, And if you notice that when I'm talking, there's a yellow box around me. And so if you can use that visual cue to let you know that someone else might be talking, because if there's two people talking at the same time, they start canceling each other out. Mm-hmm. So if you'd like to ask a question, please unmute yourself and we'll go ahead and take it. I see Cammy is ready with a question. She is pumped.
No, I was just being Dana White and demonstrating.
Oh. So any questions, you can unmute yourself and go ahead.
Bob, this is Amy. I do have a question for you. At the beginning, my internet was a little unstable and you were talking about horizontal and vertical.
Yep.
And I missed what that was, and I think that was a key aspect.
Horizontal is when you make music while you're lying down. No, I'm kidding. Okay. Horizontal is thought of as melody and by extension, combinations of melody, so counterpoint. And vertical is thought of as harmony, simultaneous notes sounding.
Bob, I someplace read that or heard that the chord structure for Paul Simon's song, An American Tune, was derived from one of the Bach chorales. Do you know anything about that?
Well, the tune itself, well, they helped all men, our brothers. It's the first, the A section of the chorale tune. But there's a Peter, Paul, and Mary song that uses the whole song. I don't know if they reference specific Bach harmonizations. You know, that tune pre-exists Bach. You know, it was a pre-existing tune, as were most of those melodies. But yeah, absolutely, you're right.
So Bob, I have a question. You talked early on about the practice where some of the pieces that Bach did, he kind of gave musicians license to do it with whatever they wanted, in whatever with whatever instruments. Was that common for Bach only, or was that typical of the period with other composers of that same time?
Well, not putting a specific orchestration was pretty common. Sometimes it was obvious. Sometimes it was for, you know, if the composer was also the conductor, as Bach usually was, you know, he or she would know what they're doing. So I don't think it was too uncommon, but for a major work like the Art of Fugue, which is, you know, a huge compendium of contrapuntal music, to not have any indication at all is definitely an attempt to say, this is counterpoint abstracted from a specific instrument. But of course you can play it. You can play it on anything you want. I mean, you know, Bach's dead. We could do anything we want to with Bach, but I think Bach then expected that people would study it in the abstract perhaps, but also play it on any number of instruments.
So it's part of your point then, Bob, the fact here that Bach was played around with more than any other composer has been, with different mediums and different instruments?
I think that's the case, yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone's done a statistical analysis, but, you know, I can't think of any other composers. I mean, certainly there are send-ups and take-offs on lots of other composers, but I don't think you have at all the same amount. And
yet we don't know why Bach.
Well, I try to explain some possible reasons, but you know, for each person who does it, each person probably has his or her own reason, own fascination. I mean, we're not all the same. We don't all love Bach for the same reason. But I think part of it is just, there's a fascination that, one of the things I didn't mention, but I do mention a lot in rehearsals and such, is that I think Bach had, to a very high degree, the ability to integrate what we call the left brain and the right brain into a single welded artifact, piece of music. And that's kind of rare, you know. I mean, most of us are unbalanced one way or the other, right? It's very few people are kind of balanced in the middle. And in his personal life, I have no idea if he was or not. But in his music, he's able to take incredibly ramified musical forms, you know, music that, you know, you could write a dissertation on. Many dissertations have been written, and analytical dissertations have been written on Bach's music. And that same music can be incredibly moving at the same time. It doesn't sound that intellectual on the face of it, but you dig down and there it is. Those two things then are able to coexist. The objective and the subjective aren't mutually exclusive. And in Bach, I think that characteristic is developed to a very high degree.
I just have to add though that you did bring out, the fact that he was awfully prolific, and I kind of had that feeling, but you have really brought that out tonight.
He was
just such a variety.
He was incredibly prolific. And as you know, we've lost a ton of his music as well. So, you know, there's about 150 cantatas missing and many, many other pieces missing. So, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, I'm happy if I get out of bed in the morning. Anybody else?
Thank you so much for sharing this really incredible collection of yours. I'm looking forward to, hope you'll share some of the links at least, especially the videos. I really want to spend all night going through the whole program again.
Absolutely. I can do that. And it might take us a day or two to put it together, but we'll definitely get that stuff to everybody.
I also recorded our session tonight. And so I'll be able to download it here when we're finished, and I'll send it out to you, and you can feel free to share it with people or listen to it for yourself or check back, and then we'll send you the links as well.
Cool. Well, thank you all so much for coming. I love you people. And it's always an honor to be with you. And thank you for the silent claps. And and let's do this again.
Yes.
Some version of it. Okay, you guys take care.
Good night, everyone. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
It
was great.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Three cheers.
Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thank you.
Everyone's leaving.
It feels like last call.
Last call.
Okay, I'm showing some.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
This is a
great.
I'm just going to go ahead and.